You're listening to Robert Kelly's
You Know What, Dude?
On the Glory Hole Radio Network, gloryholeradio.com.
You know what, dude?
Hey, what's up? This is Robert Kelly, and I am I'm doing You Know What, Dude? Podcast. I'm here with a very close friend of mine for years, almost my whole comedy career, and even closer in the latter years.
Yeah.
Gary Gulman. Mr. Gary Gulman from Torgasm. Gary Gulman. What's up?
I always like to think that I started a year and a half or so after you, and then that's how I explain to myself why you're far ahead of me.
Wow.
All these guys are far ahead of me. It was the year and a half. That Dan Cook had over me.
Can I just
that
say
allowed
that?
Him to sell out.
I do the same thing.
You do?
Yeah, I do the same thing with the, I have a year and a half to 2 years of acting that I pulled out.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, we were talking about that today. You didn't get that at all? Like, oh, I was out for two. I was like out for a year and a half.
Oh, so you subtract from that. I love the guys. Well, for the first 11 years of comedy, I only did it once a month.
Right.
Yeah, and that's why you're ahead of me.
I came up with Dane, but, you know.
Yeah, listen. Then we diverged.
Yeah. Well, I kind of did.
Sure.
I kind of did. But it was Dane's fault. He told me to stop doing comedy. Or he was going to leave Alan the Monkeys.
Oh, my gosh.
But, Gary, man, I'm really glad I got you on the podcast. I've been doing this for a while now. You know, me and you, dude, we've been through so many stages of my career together and your career, but you know, it's been a constant evolving anchor, you know, friendship in my life. You know what I mean? And people kind of get weirded out that we're friends. Like, I'll tell people that I'm friends with you and Gary. I'm like, he's one of my favorite people on the planet Earth. And people are like, really? Like, they can't imagine us.
Do you remember what Colin Quinn said about our friendship?
No, what?
Robert, you can never be friends with Gary because Gary is a winner.
Shit. I wish it's the only time I wish this was a real radio show so we could have a stupid PA call him up right now.
Yeah.
Could just fucking.
How dare you?
You cunt. Yeah, and that's why he shouldn't be friends with me.
Right.
Because I'm just above a loser.
Oh.
But you, me and you started out together.
Yes.
I started a little before you, a year and a half.
Or so. Yeah. I mean, my first show was October 8th, 1993.
It's so funny you have stats.
Oh, yeah.
And every
October 8th, I celebrate it.
Really?
Yeah.
October 8th is my birthday.
No way.
Yeah.
That's interesting because it was essentially my birthday. Was that dramatic?
That was very dramatic. And
because
now,
I never felt alive,
right,
until I was on stage.
That me neither.
Right?
I never felt alive until October 8th.
Yeah. Right. So October 8th was our birth.
But here's the deal, dude.
Me comedically, you humanly.
You have to now you can never forget my birthday.
Right.
And if you do, I'll be fucking
It's funny
insulted.
Because I always put on the calendar birth of a superstar, but I
Apparently thought it was for me.
You
were talking about somebody else.
Yeah. I was talking about somebody else. I was talking about Mr. Robert Kelly, a superstar.
Well, we met back in Beantown at Nick's Comedy Stop. I think it was the first time I saw you.
Yeah.
You came in really tall, really good looking, really big.
Yeah.
And you went on stage. And we I don't think we talked really.
No, we'd say hello. You were a friendly guy, but we came from two different worlds. That's the weird thing from in comedy is that you grew up a criminal, it sounds like, and I was like a guy who played by every rule. I mean, I wouldn't even steal a pencil from a teacher or anything like that. I'd give it back at the end of the class, and from what we discussed today, pencils were nothing to you.
No, nothing.
Nothing. You would steal a pencil and not even bat an eyelash.
I used to steal everything. But I wasn't, this is the thing too, is I wasn't a real criminal because I did have a heart. Like I wouldn't, you know, I had a hard time doing real crime.
Right.
I did real crime.
Yeah.
But I was really forced into it. But my crime, you know, my type of stuff was going into your backyard and stealing a ceramic owl.
Right. Lawn furniture.
Yeah.
And then selling it.
And selling
it. You were so shrewd.
Yeah, like I would sell, I would hit you, but it wouldn't hurt you.
Right.
It would, you'd be like, where's my drill? Where the fuck is my drill? And, you know, the fucking deli owner down the street had it.
You were a criminal with a conscience.
I was almost Robin Hood. I was helping the guy at the deli, you know, fix that wall that needs to be fixed.
Yeah.
So he didn't get shut down.
Right.
Because then if he shut down, the bakery might lose business. They might fucking shut down.
I love it, the way you were able to rationalize it.
But you, me and you became friends. One night we were talking, and you needed a job.
Yeah.
Which flipped me out, because, you know, you went to fucking, where'd you go to college?
I went to Boston College. I have an accounting degree, and I was working as an accountant, and then I got turned on to the life of comedy, and I lost that job because of my lack of doing it well. I was very bad at it because I was doing shows till late at night and then coming into work the next day late, tired. And the whole thing is you kill on stage and then you have to go to this job where nobody really thinks you're very special. And it's painful. So I was doing that, and then all of a sudden I didn't have a job, and I was able to live off my severance for a little while, and then that ran out, and I sort of started over again as a waiter. I had never waited tables.
Well, I was working. You came to me and you were like, "I'm looking for a job," and I worked at this Italian restaurant.
Yeah.
In Boston. It was at Nick's upstairs.
Yeah.
And I go, "Dude, I get you a job."
Yeah.
Because I got Al a job there. I would get a lot of, you know, because people, you know, a friend of mine got me the job and over in Brookline at the new restaurant, and you came in.
Yeah.
And you applied.
I applied, and the next day, and they gave me the job, and I was able to turn it into sometimes between $45 and $65 a day.
A day, and you were the tallest waiter ever.
And a terrible waiter. Slow,
yep.
Nervous.
You're very nervous.
And hunched over.
Yeah. You had to bend completely in half to take somebody's order.
Yeah, way too tall.
But then you got the hang of it after a while.
Yeah.
You got the hang of it, and then...
Now, do the people know that you met your wife at this restaurant?
I don't talk about my wife on the podcast. She's not mentioned. No. No, they don't. I didn't meet her at the restaurant.
Not the original restaurant that we worked at, but that got closed down because they couldn't get a liquor license.
Right. I actually met my wife at a Joey Maria's wedding, which the restaurant used to cater.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, I went in one night to drop off some chicken palm, and she was there waiting to do the Joey Maria's wedding.
She was a performer?
No, she was
catering.
Catering for
catering,
the
okay.
restaurant.
So you were dropping off some,
right.
Yeah.
And okay. then, you remember that joke, scaring people?
Yes.
You remember the way you go up to the car window at a red light?
Yeah.
And you sneak up, and they don't even know.
Hits of the 90s, yeah.
Woo!
That was a huge hit for Robert Kelly.
And she came out of the place, her and her friend Jody. Jody was, you know, a little older. Remember Jody? She had a nice body, but she had a face like a fucking cartoon character, a cartoon bird.
I don't know. I'm sure if I saw her, I would remember the cartoon bird. But
they pulled up at the red light. I went up and I scared the fuck out of them. And then I walked over. I go, "We should go out. We should go for coffee."
Wow.
I was like, dude, that was when I was hot,
too. Ballsy, yeah.
I was hot back then.
Yeah.
I was really hot. And I was like, "We should go for coffee." Like, I was the situation. If they had a fucking reality show back then, I would have been on this.
The funniest. None of those guys are funny, Bob. You're funny. On and off stage.
Yeah, they're not funny, but they're fucking entertaining. Fucking losers. But I was both.
Right.
I was a psychopath.
Yeah.
That fucking get into a fight. And I joke around a little. I had a sense of humor.
Funny, funny guy.
But then we would actually, after work, I'd jump on my motorcycle, you'd jump in your car, we'd go down downtown Boston, cigar place.
We had a few hours in between work and
comedy.
The open mic or whatever we were trying to get on. Mm-hmm. And we would smoke cigars, drink coffee, talk about comedy, and then go to a place that 9 times out of 10, not enough people showed up to do a show.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't even wind up doing a show, and we would... just hang out, maybe go back to your rumpus room of an apartment and drink whatever the grocery store's name was, that cola.
Yeah.
Whatever, Shaw's cola. Yeah. Yeah,
President.
Yeah, just crack. Couldn't even afford Coca-Cola.
Yeah, we had that shit apartment.
Yeah.
Just a shit apartment.
But a great balcony.
Yep.
And we would sit out there and talk comedy.
Yep, we'd talk comedy. And we'd talk comedy a lot.
Yeah.
And we became really good friends. And then I forget what happened. What, did you move or did I move? You moved.
You moved.
I moved.
Yeah. You moved to New York first.
Okay.
And I continued to do the local scene in Boston. And I became a middle act, which goes up before the headliner.
Right.
And I worked on my jokes. And so you were about a year and a half or so ahead of me to New York. But I remember staying with you at an apartment.
97th Street.
Yeah.
That was Billy Burr's apartment.
Yeah, Billy Burr's apartment.
He actually let me move in.
But you weren't there when I first got there. And I just, you had left me the key. I went in there, I fell asleep. And then your roommate, Akeen, came in.
Yeah.
And I didn't know who he was. It was just a black man who walked into your apartment one day. And I called you up and I said, hey, I didn't know that. I thought Billy Burr was your roommate. And you said, well, who's there? And I told you, and you said, he's not supposed to be there. Get him out. You made me think that he was an intruder.
We couldn't understand him. Me and Billy would just laugh when he laughed, like a soundtrack.
He was a really nice guy, though.
Great guy. Akeen was a fucking great guy, because he let Billy, who subletted from him, like a space.
Okay.
He let him sublet it to me.
Wow.
Because Billy was in LA shooting townies.
Yeah.
And he would come home once in a while. But to keep the pad, you know, I paid most of the rent. And then when he came home, I would just hit the couch.
Do you remember what the rent was?
$325.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
But it did go up. It went up. It got a little expensive. It went to $350.
You can make that in a weekend of doing spots.
Dude, I can make that panhandling.
Right?
Yeah, I could sell shaved ice one day a week.
Oh, that's fantastic. And 97th and what was it?
It's 97th and Lex. One block away from the projects.
It's
and
fantastic.
One block away.
That
to
one
where
block. It's done. Imagine what you could have gotten it for. It would have been a block up.
It would have been 210.
210.
We had to do our laundry at the projects, though. In the basement.
Oh, wow.
Which I loved. I fucking loved. I loved sitting on the stoop and looking down, seeing a crack addict taking a shit.
We used to do a lot of talking on that stoop. You pronounced it stoop.
Stoop.
Which is also a Yiddish word, which means to fuck. Stoop. And the other thing that I always tell people is that wherever I've lived in New York City, you hooked up there. At every section. There's not a place I can tell you I've either had a meal or lived where you can't tell me what position and what nationality the girl you hooked up with. You're like a salmon. You know exactly where you got laid, and you could take me back there at any point.
And someday I'm going to go back there and die.
Where are you living, Gare? I'm at 39th and 2nd. I once bent a Puerto Rican chick over a railing in a balcony. She only had 1 foot. Dude, she only had 1 foot.
I used to have an Indian chick eat my ass over there. Fucking the East Village.
Yeah.
I did bang a lot of broads. You know the worst fuck I ever had?
Tell me.
Israeli girl.
Really?
Worst lay ever. So bad. Now, I came out of the cellar one night, and this happened to me many times. I'd come off stage, and there'd be a girl there who saw me before, and they would come when they saw me on the show and wait in the hallway. And I came off one night, and she's like, she went, oh, my God, she had an Israeli accent. She goes, I think you're so funny. And I walked up, do you? And I walked up, and I just started kissing her.
Wow.
Just started making out with her.
Oh, my God. You're like Robert Goulet.
Back then, I was fucking bad.
Wow.
So we hooked up. We started.
I need like an invitation and sign a contract before I do something like that. I want to make sure that I don't get charged with something. You just start kissing.
I walked off stage.
If I had your balls. Oh my gosh.
And then I remember we would, when we fucked for the first time, I thought it was just her being nervous. So I let it go. The second time, dude, she would just, her rhythm was off.
Really?
Like she didn't know how to fuck.
Wow.
And she's beautiful, dude. I'm talking thin waist.
Big tits.
Small tits.
Really? Not the Israeli really, women not, usually have...
Not really big tits.
Golan Heights.
Beautiful, huge booty. But like not fat, not...
Yeah.
Just this beautiful booty.
Yeah.
Beautiful eyes. Beautiful. Oh my gosh. She was really gorgeous.
Yeah.
But she sucked.
Wow. And
I mean, I would get aggravated. One time I remember going, I remember yelling at her going, come on. Let's go. Move your fucking hips.
Wow.
Like that bad.
What are you doing?
Yeah. Almost to that point.
Ah, it's infuriating.
I was so fucking aggravated. And that's why I stopped seeing her because it was just, it sucked.
Wow.
It sucked. And I remember, oh man, she was so hot. And her roommates were hot. It was just a great little, she lived in the East Village. I used to fucking,
she just wasn't your speed.
What?
She would have been right up my alley.
Couldn't
I'd love
fuck.
To date an Israeli girl.
Couldn't fuck, yeah. I mean, I was excited.
Of course.
She had a gun for 2 years.
Of course. Not only like a Jewish woman, like Israeli Jewish, that's a different thing.
She
I'm sure you've
military.
Had your share of Jewish women.
Yes, I have. I have. I used to bang a Jewish broad right across the street from the cellar.
Jew broad.
Right. Right across the street from the cellar. She had an awesome one-bedroom apartment.
Oh.
So I'd do my spots all night, hang out, and then I'd go meet her over there. And I'd get to sleep, you know, I'd stay over. I remember one night we were outside of her
not
place.
Not have to go all the way back up to 97, 96. And
God, dude.
Lex.
That fucking 6 train.
Yeah.
Was the worst. Because I couldn't afford a cab all the time back then. So I'd have to wait
for
that.
To me, getting a cab
train.
Is like going to a prostitute. Only if it's been, yeah. Well, very rarely will I. I don't go to prostitutes, but
I don't
use a cab.
I don't anymore, but I have my share of those, too. That's the worst part of it. I could get laid by regular chicks all the time, and I'd still go to a whore.
Really?
I don't know. Just something about it.
Yeah.
Something about the hunt.
Is it true that they don't kiss you? Is that, or is that just a pretty woman thing?
Oh, no, that's...
You don't want to kiss a prostitute, right?
You don't want to, but I have, like, hot ones, like, you know, like blue chip hookers in Vegas.
How much would that be for a blue chip?
$5.
$500? Cash, right?
Yeah, but I never paid it. I had somebody pay for it. I'll tell you a funny story. Girl knocks on my door. She's, gorgeous. I mean, just a regular looking chick in jeans and a cool shirt. And I thought she was a fan.
Oh.
And she comes in and we talk. And
never make that mistake.
Yeah, she started.
Somebody recognizes you.
Well,
assume
I was in my hotel
that it's
room.
From high school.
I'm in my room.
Right, right.
So I'm thinking they sent her up or whatever. She comes in, dances, takes her clothes off. She starts dancing. I start dancing.
Oh.
Then I wound up going.
How are you at dancing? Do you have pretty good rhythm?
No.
No moves?
No. I got some moves. All I think right. I could have been a dancer.
Yeah.
Like for Madonna.
Right.
That type of dancer. I'm not kidding.
No, I believe that.
I have.
You have the courage and rhythm.
I don't have the courage. That's what
no?
I'm lacking.
Oh.
Yeah. I used to dance at all the weddings when I was a kid.
Oh.
I was like a little hit. And I would, you know, they would pay me. They'd
wow.
give me yeah, because I made the wedding. Because cute little Bobby was out there doing Danny Terrio moves. But I remember I got this girl.
Who broke your spirit?
I got. Hang on, let me tell this. Shut the fuck up. Dude, Billy Manchington. That's who it was.
Yeah. I used to be very entertaining at weddings, too, until my brothers broke my spirit.
Yeah. There's somebody always that fucking makes you insecure.
Keep you in your place.
Yes.
Yeah. Don't be so obnoxious.
Yeah. Shut your face.
Yeah.
All right, kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, and then all of a sudden somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All of a sudden you start to stand out.
I went down on this girl because I liked her. And I kissed her, made out with her, and I went down and made her have an orgasm.
Wow.
The guy called up. He goes, "How did that girl come up?" I go, "Yeah, she was awesome. We're going to hang out later." He goes, I go, "Yeah, dude." He goes, "Did you fuck her?" I go, "No."
Wait, who's the guy?
The guy who booked the gig.
Oh, okay.
He goes, "Did you fuck her?" I go, "No. I'm not, I like her." He's like, "Dude, she's a whore.
Oh.
She cost me $5. You didn't fuck her?" I go, "No, I went down on her." He goes, "You went down on her, you fucking idiot?"
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, that's horrible.
Yeah.
So sad.
Yeah, and it was like,
I like her.
Yeah, I like her.
I like her.
She was smoking.
At least you didn't abandon your entire life and support her and just talk yourself into it.
Why did you? That's the thing. Here, let's get into this, dude. You go to L.A.
Yeah.
From Boston. I you don't go to New York.
I lived on Joe Matarese's couch in Queens, Astoria, Queens.
For how long?
For 3 months, $325 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Sleep on his couch in Queens. which is right about what you paid for Billy Burr's apartment at 96th
and Lex. But how did you get to, how, what, I mean, you went into New York and became successful.
Or, no.
Wait a minute.
No.
What happened, dude?
I was getting the comedy cellar food spots.
Okay.
And I was going at 1 o'clock in the morning or whatever, getting a food spot, and then I stopped getting any spots anywhere. And
really?
Because I wasn't doing that well at that hour. I just, my act wasn't strong enough. So I went back to Boston because I could always get on stage there. And
I think I remember sitting on the stoop one night and we had this conversation where you're like, I'm thinking of going back to Boston.
No, I'll tell you exactly what happened because I remember that stoop.
Okay. All right.
So I'd been in Boston for about a year working on my shit. And I finally got to a point where I felt like I know what I'm doing now. I'm going to go back to New York. And this comedy manager set up an audition for me.
Right.
At the old Gotham Comedy Club. And I bombed so hard.
Right.
And then ever bomb, you run through your act so fast that there's several minutes left at the end.
Yes.
And the hosts try to have a social life during the show.
Right.
So they're nowhere to be found.
Right.
So this probably never happened to you, but
dude, it's happened to me.
Okay. All right. So I'm standing on stage with only my dick in my hand. I got no more jokes left. I've run through my 2 hours of material.
Right.
4 minutes or whatever. You know how you, some nights it takes you 2 hours to do 6 minutes of material. Other nights you run through it in a minute, but the laughs and the audience enjoying you. Yeah. You add a little thing here or there.
It just happened to me in Montreal.
Oh.
At the gala. Not that I was doing bad, but I ran through the jokes and they weren't laughing as long as they were at the cellar in New York when I was practicing this set. So I got to 8 minutes. I had 2 minutes left. I had to add a joke.
Oh yeah, of course.
Thank God I'm a professional. And I knew what to do.
Yeah.
And I didn't panic.
Yeah.
But
those 3 seconds in your head feel like, when you're trying to come up with the thing. No, I know.
Yeah.
It's usually the opposite. But here's the thing. So I run through that. Gregory Carey, who was a Boston comedian, was the host.
Yeah, I remember him.
I'm standing there. And then 45 seconds at least, I say, oh, he's not coming back. I better do another joke. And of course, that joke destroys. And I meet with the guy who had wanted to see me, the manager. And he's like, we were supposed to go out to dinner afterwards, talking about my career. And he said, listen, I think you should go back to Boston for a couple of years and work on your thing.
A couple of years?
Yeah, a couple of years, year
who
and a half.
Who was his manager?
Two. Rick Dorfman.
He said a couple of years.
Yeah, Rick the Dorf Dorfman. And then, so I went back to your place that night and I was like, Bobby, I was devastated. I was devastated. I remember walking in a daze into the traffic, just, you know, the taxi cabs whizzing by me as I'm like, oh, my one. You always think you only get one chance in this business. Turns out they give you like 3,000.
Yeah.
You get to blow 3,000 chances to fail at this. You only get one shot, kid. You get thousands of shots. Thank God. Thank God. Yeah. This was my first one, so I went back.
Because we need all 3,000 of those shots.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm on 29.98. So I go back to your place. You're probably out doing spots until 4 o'clock in the morning. Anyhow, we wake up the next day. We go out on the stoop, and I'm like, I don't know what to do. I got completely obliterated last night, and I think I'm just gonna take his advice and go back to Boston for a couple of years.
Right.
The thing was is that I had another audition the following week for Barry Katz's company, Maureen Tarrin, mm-hmm. who was a partner with him. She's a woman manager, and I said, I don't know if I should go for it because I'm just going to blow another one of my 3,000 opportunities.
Yeah.
And you were like, dude, you're not going anywhere. You're coming back. You're doing that spot, and you're not giving up and running with your tail between your legs back to Boston. You're not going to run away from this. You know, you gave me an awesome pep talk.
Right,
you were like Mickey and Rocky. It was very typical, typical Robert. You've probably given me 60 of those, 60 of those this weekend. These pep talks, and so then I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna come back, and I came back. I did the audition. That was like 1998, October, right about the time of that would have been my fifth anniversary of doing comedy.
Right.
And it was 1998, and I went back and did the audition, went on right after Jim Gaffigan. This was before Gaffigan was huge, but he was, here was the thing with Gaffigan back then. Not only did he have those funny, weird jokes about manatees and stuff like that, he was also pretty dirty.
He was real
dirty. He was really dirty.
Fucking dirty.
And this was the Boston Comedy Club full, and he killed, and I'm like panicking. I'm like, even before Gaffigan was huge nationally, we all knew that this guy was a heavy hitter, and everybody talked, oh, you hear Gaffigan's, he was just legendary already.
He was a dirty comic.
And he was really dirty and creepy. Yeah. Creepy dirty. Like, the horse fucker was one of his big jokes.
Yeah.
That was his nickname back in Indiana. You can't escape your past. Welcome back, horse fucker. You do one thing, like stuff like that. So I go on after him. I'm shaking. I'm like, here we go again. And for whatever reason, the collection of jokes worked. I was likable or whatever. The whole thing is, we were probably never good early, but we were likable and we would do well.
Right.
And so she called me that Monday and she was like, I want to work with you. And within 9 months of that date where that guy told me to go back to Boston for 2 years, I got Letterman, Leno, Premium Blend, a development deal at Fox for $250,000.
Yeah.
And it was like, back then when they, because I did Montreal, that was the thing. I got Montreal later that year, and it like, and I went from living with my mom to having an apartment in LA within a year of that. So it was just, it was dramatic how quickly your life could change.
It was crazy.
That type of circumstances.
I remember that. I remember you fucking shot. You were just gone, dude. And then you were in LA.
Yeah, for 6 years.
You went to LA, and you were with Barry Katz. Who I was with Barry Katz, but not with Barry Katz. I was with Matt
Frost.
I was with
Maureen.
Right, Maureen.
I worked with Maureen.
I love Maureen. I
love her.
Love Maureen. But I wasn't. I was with Matt. I was kind of Matt's guy, but Matt was the booking guy who wanted to be a manager.
Yeah,
and I was his first guy. Me and Corielli.
Oh wow!
But
I didn't know
Corielli,
that.
Yeah, he brought Corielli in, and then but Corielli went with Maureen.
Okay,
because Maureen was like, I like Pete, and Pete was like, let me go over here.
Yeah.
And I stuck with Matt. Nobody really liked me. Barry, I remember Barry, we were at the meeting, and he goes, well, Matt's going to be your guy. I go, no, that's the way I want it. I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
And then I remember I booked a movie, two movies and a TV show of VJ for Burly Bear Network.
That's right.
Where I was an MTV VJ.
Yeah.
And Ann Harris worked there at Burly Bear too. Now she's one of the big dogs at Comedy Central.
Wow.
We did a Burly Bear tour. We did all this weird shit. But and then the company broke up.
Oh yeah.
And they went to LA.
Yeah.
And you went with the big part of the company, and I stayed in New York with Frosty. Frosty was my manager all the way up until Tourgasm.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And I remember I looked over at him, and he's on the bus with Dane, helping Dane do shit.
Yeah.
And he was like, you know, had to deal with Dane because he was Dane's agent.
Right.
And I went, if he's Dane's agent and he's doing all this shit, what the fuck is he doing for me right now?
Right.
As a manager.
Yeah.
You know, this can't work.
Yeah.
And I had to talk with him and we brought it. But
yeah. There are so many conflicts of interest within management. And that was like even egregious for the nature of the business.
Well, you went to LA. Me and you had a falling out, dude. We had a fucking falling out for a while because, you know, I was old school, fucking, you know, Boston is a code that you keep, you know, and me and you got really tight. You were one of my, I knew how, I don't know how to say it. You were just a solid guy. You were no bullshit. You had rules and regulations. You had a code too.
Yeah.
And I remember when you went to LA, you were gone. And I remember hearing all this crazy shit about you. It was almost like you were kind of successful in this business overnight. 9 months, but that's overnight.
Yeah.
And you were in LA and then we stopped talking. We stopped talking. And, and I don't remember if it's after you got... No, I think it was before you got Last Comic Standing.
Oh, yeah. I think when I moved to L.A., we didn't talk for a couple of years until you moved out there. And I just, you know, it...
I didn't understand the comic life back then because I was coming from Boston with Patrice and you and Dane, and we all kept in touch. But like, but people don't understand, as civilians, you guys talk all the time. You have the same friends pretty much your whole life, or they evolve, but you talk every day, or you're every week, or you go to a barbecue, or you go to a bar, or you see each other. But comics, which I learned, you go away for years, or you go away for months, and you don't talk.
Yeah.
And it's not that you don't like each other, or fuck you. And I'm this is my part I'm going to own.
Right.
Is that you have to understand that your life goes off so fast in a different direction that you're just so focused on doing what you're doing. But most of the time you'll call up, what's up? What's going on? Nothing. Where you been? You know, it's 9 months. And it's like,
yeah,
dude, I was fucking, oh, cool. And it's right back to where you left off.
That's the one thing. I remember I had a priest who was a professor at Boston College, and he told me something that I never forgot when I was like 19 years old. He said, your real friends, you can go years without talking to them and you pick up right where you left off. Those are real friends. But when I think about it now, when you say, oh, Gary, you got really successful really quickly, I think that now that I recall, there were a couple of things going on there. One, you say that and I'm like, well, what are you talking about successful? I never felt like, I always felt like, yeah, you got these deals, but it didn't mean that you were famous or on TV or anything like that, and it never guaranteed anything, and it was just a weird time in comedy. So there was at least a subconscious feeling that here's Bobby Kelly who's I always felt was funnier than everybody, and now here I am getting the tap to come into the game and have all these things and go on TV and have a development deal. Well, that's not really fair because Bobby Kelly is funnier than I am, and so I probably felt a little bit fraudulent and probably had some survivor's guilt about being luckier, because that's what nobody tells you when they make it. They say, I worked hard and I had a natural talent for this. Nobody ever says, oh, I got really it was I got into a thing, they picked me over some other people who were just as funny, and this person saw me and it clicked and whatever, and I had a meeting and for whatever reason I said this instead of that, and they wrote a check for me because they had heard that some other company wanted to write me a check, and that's how it happens. I love it when these guys say, well, you know, you just got to get so good, and shut up. Shut up. There's a lot of luck involved, and the people who don't feel a little bit of either survivor's guilt, that, like Kurt Vonnegut always said that with his other author friends. He was like, there's no rhyme or reason as to why I'm more famous and more acceptable than these guys or Mark Twain over other guys or whatever. It's just, and I probably felt that way, and sometimes it's hard to be successful with friends. It's easy to struggle with friends,
right?
Because you can share commiserating and the struggle and working hard, but then you feel, I almost felt like ashamed, like look at me, I got over on everybody, and but the whole thing is, now that we know over 20 years everything evens out, and you have ups and downs, and it's a long thing. I love that thing with Joan Rivers and Louis C.K., which was on the Louis show, where she's just like ups and downs, and it's a roller coaster. But the bottom line is, we love to get on stage every night and tell jokes.
Yeah. Well, we actually worked it out. I called you up. We talked. I was pretty fucking honest.
Yeah.
I was like, what the fuck, dude? You know, and you were like, I'm sorry. And, you know, we worked it out. And from that day on, it was dead.
Yeah.
And then we cut to...
We had a lot of fun on the Torgasm.
Well, cut to Torgasm, dude.
Yeah.
Where I find out you're doing it. And, you know, and Jay Davis is doing it. And we get on that fucking bus, man.
Oh.
And it was, you know... Most people, what the fuck was that?
Oh, that was just my phone. Somebody texted me.
What do you, did your phone have a bell in it?
Well, it's also the start of the boxing match between my phone and whoever texted me.
We got on that bus and it was a fucking grueling month. People think we had this blast, this crazy time where it was so beautiful. Holy shit. Oh, man. Wow. Can you talk about that?
I just got a text from a girl I've been dating.
My God.
A very pretty picture.
Pretty picture. That's one way to put it.
Yeah.
Well, hang on one second. Hang on one second. I wish I knew how to pause this fucking thing, which I don't, because if I hit a button, I'll fucking just lose the whole podcast.
Oh, my God.
By the way, that fucking towel on the floor over there?
Yeah, that's what I figured. I avoided it. You know, I even when I'm on the road, I use toilet paper.
Really?
Yeah, because somebody has to pick that freaking thing up tomorrow.
Yeah, and that's why I leave money on the fucking... I leave a 20.
You should leave money and tongs and salad tongs and... Wow. And
like if you're a maid and you're not using gloves, that's your fault. Okay, here's a 20. Use some gloves. Let's call it even.
You leave a 20, huh?
Yeah. I got that from Quinn.
Really?
Yeah, I was. He was doing a NACA convention, and I was there. And he went up, and it was the funniest story ever. 3,000 people after. Who's the fucking loud guy? Lewis Black.
Oh. Yeah, that's what he likes to be called, the loud guy.
Well,
the man does incisive political commentary, and Robert Kelly reduced him to the loud guy. The man is a voice of a generation, and you call him the loud guy.
I'm calling him a caller.
That's what they used to call Dane Cook
in
Boston when he first started, the loud guy.
That's what they call Godfrey now.
What is this, a yelling contest?
So he goes up after him. Lewis kills 3,000 students and Trinitron screens. Collins at his fattest.
Trinitron, really? They had a 1970s Sony television?
No, they had the big screens.
Jumbotron.
No, they call them Trinitrons.
Are you sure?
I don't know. I'm just.
Yeah,
I
think you might have pulled that out of your ass.
I am sure.
Really?
Two Trinitrons. And I remember he bombed. His sweat. Coming down his face. And he comes off stage. He was like, fucked. He got right the fuck out of there. I went up to his room. Because I didn't have a room. I had to split a room with my agent. So I go, dude, what are you leaving? He goes, yeah. He goes, can I take your room? He goes, God, I don't give a shit. So he let me have his room.
I just, because I worship Colin Quinn as a saint of comedy.
Unbelievable.
And a genius of comedy. Yes. And just as good as anybody who's ever done it.
Biggest earlobes, too, in the comedy business. Go ahead.
I was getting to that. If you would let me finish.
Go ahead.
Biggest earlobes in comedy. And to hear that he bombed, like, that's even possible. But it is possible. And it happens sometimes because he takes a lot of chances and he's true to himself.
Yeah.
And it's just infuriating that he had to go through that. And it just, how long ago was that? Because I want to know if
it had to be years ago. It was before Tough Crowd.
So he was probably in his 30s?
It was a year before Tough Crowd. No, 30s. What the fuck? That was 40s.
Really? Yeah. He's older than he looks then.
Yeah, he's, I don't know. I think he's like, I don't know how old he is.
All right, whatever.
But 40s. But he, he left a 20. I remember he left a 20 on the table. He goes, yeah. And he's like, yeah, he always leaves, you always see him popping a 20 to the waitresses at the cellar.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a big tipper.
Yeah.
Which I was like, you know what? That's, it's kind of given out there. You know, the people.
When I've been rich and I've been poor. You've had six fats. I've had three riches.
Right.
I've been rich three times.
Right.
And my second rich was after Last Comic Standing, and I used to tip the doormen at hotels 20s. I threw around 20s. I was an animal. I was an animal, and I wish I had that $30,000 back.
You're not as bad as fucking Jamie Giorgio. He used to tip the toll guy.
Oh, I know.
The toll was a dollar. He'd tip him three.
It's Public Greenwich Village.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, dude. So you get fucking Last Comic Standing.
Yeah. 2004.
Fucking crazy fame.
Yeah, I got famous, but what they don't tell you that there's an expiration date on the fame unless you do something else really quickly.
Yeah.
There is an expiration date on it. And
you have to tell me. I was on Tourgasm with you.
Right? Yeah. Somebody should have told.
Yeah, there's no.
Somebody should have told us, but it would have been mean. We would have been like, fuck you. You're just jealous.
Yeah.
Nope.
There's an expiration date.
You better get on something quickly after that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's bizarre. And it's not. It's cruel. It's cruel.
Oh, the fame is great.
Oh, it's a lot
of
fun.
How great is it when you.
Because you always felt you deserved it.
Yeah.
You still do.
We still do.
Yeah.
We're in fucking Connecticut at the fucking Farmington Inn.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah.
But here's the difference, bro. We're happy.
Yes.
Back then.
With the fame,
we weren't happy.
We weren't happy.
After, you got that fucking huge, you know, Last Comic, and then we went on Tourgasm together. We did that. That came out on HBO, which was fucking crazy, but still weren't happy. Wasn't happy.
Nope.
And now I think, you know, like Louis C.K. always says, it's like comedy is like going to school. It's like a whole lifetime of schooling. It's first through sixth, seventh, eighth. You got 9 through 12, and then you got 4 years of college. And by the time that's done, you should be a comic.
Yeah.
You should be a paid professional comedian, knowing what the fuck you're doing, with the opportunity to write or create your way in this business.
Wow.
And he's right. He's like, it's like 19 years or 18 years for you.
Yeah, yeah,
or
yeah.
It's, you know, 19 something years for me. And we finally at the place where I'm happy in my life.
Yeah.
And, you know, comedy, you know, I'm happy in comedy too.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I've done shows this, you know, last couple months with Leary in front of 5,000 people, and I'm doing this show tonight with you, and I'll do The Cellar, and I just did Utah. It doesn't matter where I am. I'm constantly happy.
Yeah.
And I'm not worried about the outcome of my career.
Yeah.
I'm worried about the content.
Right.
Instead of the fame.
Yeah.
I care about what the fuck I'm doing.
Yeah.
And how I'm doing
it. You're still killing, but now it's a question of how am I going to kill? What am I going to kill with? And it's just...
You've been a very great joke writer.
Oh, thanks.
You've been you know what I mean? You take a subject, and you got shit for this too. You know, people would say, yeah, he talks about fucking grapes or some shit.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, but he... Who took the subject of fruit or whatever and broke it down all the way?
Yeah.
Yeah, you got a good joke out of it. And that's where we stop.
Yeah.
That's a good joke.
Yeah.
You went, fuck it. Let's keep going. I want to fucking go. And you squeezed that fucking grape dry.
Yeah.
And got fucking every joke out of it. Because it's about writing the joke and finding where the joke is. You're very analytical joke writer. You have the setup, punch, tag, but you know one thing that you've come across in the last couple of years too is that now you're adding this fucking way of thinking and your opinions and who you really are to your act, which is real interesting to see. When a joke writer becomes personal is fucking great.
Oh wow, that's a really good compliment. I mean, as far as trying to squeeze every laugh out of the things, it was a necessity, because when I was in LA and other places, I didn't get on stage that much, so I didn't get to try out a lot of new, brand new stuff.
Right.
But I could add tags and things to the things that already worked. And
oh, no shit.
Yeah, and I remember there was the best advice I got as far as joke writing early on was Paul Nardizzi, who's a legend in Boston. He used to say he would write in circles. He would take something that was already working, because the hardest thing to write new stuff is to come up with a completely new thing, because you have to try it out, find out if it works, and then work on it. But if you have something that already works, you've got a place to start, and you have the audience with you for that part, and you can add little things. And it's almost like I always felt like, all right, you may not come up with something new and brilliant every day, but you can try and think of a new line or a way to shorten. I once read that, you know, Seinfeld would feel good if he took 10 words out of a setup or something like that, or he'd work on that. And it just, I was always impressed with guys like that and their work ethic. And I said, listen, I have this easy job that I love and I'm being compensated for. I can improve by doing that, by trying to delve deeper. And it was... I always felt that it was very superficial and everything like that, but at the very least, I felt like I owed it to the art form to be original,
right.
And nobody else was talking about grapes and crap like that. So,
but yeah, you got on, you know, the other thing that kind of follows you around though is that you're a fucking big guy,
yeah,
and you don't take shit, you know, like people say. Because the type of comic you are,
yeah,
you're not
confrontational.
Yeah, you're not a, but you are. Yeah. You don't take shit if some you fucking choked out an audience member.
I never choked an audience. I never choked out an audience member.
Dude, I love that you have fucking this good boy image.
But there are myths.
Yeah, but you have little legacies, a little myths surrounded by you.
And they've grown and grown. Like I knocked out Jay Moore, supposedly.
You didn't knock out Jay Moore.
No.
No, you just grabbed him.
Yeah,
I had fucking what's his name? Fucking Jesus, my brain's flaking, dude.
We haven't slept much.
Alonzo, Jesus, I love Alonzo.
Yeah,
I flaked on me.
Yeah,
I had Alonzo him on Bowden. The podcast.
Okay,
and he told me what happened.
Oh wow,
that Jay bust balls.
Yeah,
and he would fuck with Dane sometimes, and you're very protective. You're very protective of your friends.
Oh yeah, I'm very loyal.
You're very loyal, very protective of your friends. And your Jewish heritage.
Yeah.
And you're 6'4". I'm kidding. 6'6".
No, I know.
You used to get so mad at me.
Oh, yeah,
I'd say 6'4".
Yeah. Stop cutting me down 2 inches.
Yeah. Yeah. 6'6".
Yeah. Yeah.
I saw your fucking eyes.
I was wondering whether I should correct you for the 60th time.
So you're 6'6". And you're a big motherfucker, but you're in shape too.
Yeah.
You played football.
Right.
For BC.
Yeah.
And you fucking don't take shit. You don't take shit. You're the sweetest, most lovable guy when you sit down and talk. You laugh. You have a great laugh. It's contagious. You'll love to talk jokes and goof around and do gay voice for hours. But if someone says something that offends you, You'll fucking snap like me.
Yeah.
You'll snap just like me, like you fucking cocksucker.
Yeah.
And now you have this reputation of a guy who will fucking choke somebody out. And you had the one with the guy with the video camera at the club, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I took his video camera because he was heckling me, and then he wanted to video record his girlfriend. And so after I got off, I said, all right, you want to... He was also a comedian. That's what killed me. And heckling me. And I said, all right, you're not going to get to record your girlfriend.
And what'd you do?
And I just took it. And she went on. And after she was done, I gave it back.
And he couldn't do anything about it.
And he couldn't do anything about it.
And the Jay Moore thing, you just choked him.
No, I didn't choke him. I grabbed him by the area where you, as an offensive lineman, you would block somebody to keep him away from the quarterback. So I grabbed him in the area between your shoulders. If he was wearing shoulder pads, I would have grabbed his shoulder pads. But he was wearing a shirt. So I grabbed him and I was at stage center.
Right.
And I dragged him over to stage right, and there were those walls, but they're stage walls. So when you throw somebody against it by their back into it, it shakes because it's not stable.
Yeah.
So it looks like I'm killing him. But I pinned him to the wall, and we worked it out. And the great thing about him is that I could have been fired for that. He was the executive producer of the show and the host of the show, and he stood by me. Because he's a decent guy that way. He knew that he...
Well, he's a comic, man.
Yeah, he had pressed a button, and I had overreacted. Yeah. But the next day, I was in meetings with lawyers and producers, and it was just, will you ever do it again? And I'm like, no. But in my head, I'm like, well, if he doesn't make fun of Dane's act, no. But,
me and you have gotten into it.
Oh, yeah.
Me and you got into it. I know two times. I remember two times. Two epic battles.
One when we were waiting tables.
No, then it's three times.
Yeah.
'Cause I don't remember that one.
All right.
I remember the jacuzzi in Cabo.
Yeah.
And I remember on tour.
Yeah.
After Tourgasm, our tour with Jay Davis.
Yes.
The After Tourgasm tour.
Yeah.
Where we got into it. That one, we were on the road. We were together every day. We went through we went through snowstorms.
Yeah.
We had to hire that fucking guy to get us out of Buffalo.
Oh.
It was just tiring.
It was just lack of sleep and hunger.
And then we were in the dressing room. I don't know what, San Fran or somewhere.
San Francisco. This is what happened. I bombed. I didn't show up for the meet and greet afterwards because I was humiliated. And you came back and you were like, where the fuck were you? You held up the thing and it was selfish. And I went back at you. And then...
Because there was a lot of people waiting for you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So now it's fucking with my self-esteem.
Yeah, 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 of course.
They're waiting in line. They're like, where's Gary? I'm like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then Jay Davis separated us by saying that the power of Christ compels us. He felt we needed an exorcism.
Well, we were screaming.
Yeah.
We were,
we were toe-to-toe, like two, this is the way Bobby described it. We were like two old circus tigers.
Yeah.
Bedraggled sphinxes.
And we were screaming, fuck you, you fuck. Yeah, yeah, no, yeah. Fuck you, I fuck. We're going face-to-face. I was on my tippy toes.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were bending
and
down.
You were like, I don't give a fuck, I'll knock you out. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
No, no. You fucking snapped. I mean, dude, I'm sitting there looking around the room with my peripheral for a stick, something, taking knee out.
Oh,
and
God.
Jay Davis gets in the middle of us and grabs both of our shirts like a fucking evangelist.
Yes.
And goes, the power of Christ compels you. And he stopped us dead in our tracks. And I look at him, I go, he's Jewish. And then we had the one in Cabo because I would throw around the word liberal.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You didn't like liberals back then.
Well,
maybe
yeah.
You still don't, but I'm like a liberal socialist leaning bleeding heart.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was Obama was in the election, but he was like the third or fourth. And
very early.
Yeah, it was very early, and I was insisting that this black guy was gonna be changing the world and becoming president, and you got mad about my liberal leanings, and we were at a mansion
on the beach
in an infinity pool.
No, we were in a jacuzzi.
Oh, okay,
me, you, Dane, Barry Katz. Dane's brother, who's now in jail, which we didn't know then.
Right. Brian Folkweis.
Brian Folkweis and Jay Davis.
Yeah.
In a jacuzzi. A huge jacuzzi. There was an infinity pool.
Yeah.
A mansion on the ocean.
Yeah.
The fucking
with servants and a chef.
Yeah. And massage. People would come and massage you.
Yeah.
You had a personal chef.
Yeah.
And me and you, it was 1:30 in
and
the morning.
And these two North Shore animals.
At the top of our lungs.
Top of our lungs, swearing.
You said something. I remember you stood up in the jacuzzi and went, fuck you. You went, I'm fucking sick of you, fucking. And you snapped, and I snapped. And we both just started fucking screaming.
Yeah.
Fuck you. It went from this political conversation
yeah.
to a fucking verbal Boston street
fight. It was like that
fight.
Scene when Nick DiPaolo fought Louis.
Yeah.
But it was
what
real.
It was like.
Yeah. Yeah. But it wasn't an acting.
And, I mean, you could hear it.
Yeah. And I remember Dane being like, guys, we're never going to be allowed back here if you don't quiet down.
We're never coming back here
anyway.
And that
made sense to us.
Well, no, I think we went on for a little bit. But then here's the thing with me and you is that we both have these tempers.
Yeah.
You know, but that's not who we are.
No, we have very poor impulse control.
Very poor.
And this is what I always say when I'm doing these crazy things, such as dragging the executive producer across the stage and stealing a heckler's video camera. People say afterwards, now you're calm. What do you think? And I said, I have to insist that it seemed perfectly reasonable. Perfectly reasonable at the time to react so with the adrenaline and the righteous anger, because I was right. You shouldn't heckle somebody, and you shouldn't make fun of a guy's close friend on a TV set.
Right.
And yet my reaction is so out of proportion.
Yeah.
Normal people either keep their mouth shut or say, you know what, that really hurts my feelings. and I wish
that's
you would
Alan talking.
Yeah, I wish you would stop that. Right. And we are, and it's not like you know, you to a lesser extent, but I wasn't raised as a guy who was on the streets fighting all the time. But there's my father is the same way. It must be a genetic thing where his temper. He's in a nursing home now, and he's holding grudges against a certain nurse. And the woman says to him, "Are you gonna apologize to Gina or whatever he's?" And he's like, "Never, never." I'm like, "Dad, you first of all, you'll be able to uphold that because you're 85 years old. You will be able to never apologize to her. I'm sure you can last however many years you have left, 5, 10, I hope to 20, but." What is the point?
Right.
What is the point?
I remember you had a list at one point. You got mad at somebody. You go, he's on the list. He made the fucking list. And you, when you go, once you get on the list, you don't get off.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah, there's no list anymore, but there probably was at least.
Oh, you named the people on the list.
There probably was
the
at least
dates, the names.
A mental. There was probably at least a mental list, if not written down or on whatever the notes were. But there was a list. I think it was. Yeah, I used to drive by the Laugh Factory in L.A. and scream "Fuck you, Laugh Factory!" because I would go in every week and not get a single spot.
Oh God,
no spots for you this week. And like a nut, I would drive by and scream "Fuck you, Laugh Factory!" And when I had a girlfriend, she would participate in the "Fuck you, Laugh Factory" with me.
It's this is funny too, though. Speaking of girlfriends, you've had a couple girlfriends comedians,
yeah,
that took you down the fucking crazy road, man.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You, we don't have to mention names,
no,
because I don't want to get into it. But you know, I always remember you'd hook up with these girls, and I'd be like, oh boy, because my rule is, you don't date somebody with a headshot.
Yes.
You don't date somebody with hopes and dreams.
Yep.
That, similar to yours.
Right.
They can have hopes and dreams, but you have to be the drama mama. If you're a comedian, you have to be the drama mama. They have to be the civilian, the square that would never get on stage. I don't want to know and won't even come up there on New Year's. No, just do your thing. I'll wait down. You can't do that. And I remember you used to love dating chicks with headshots.
Yeah.
And I would be like, oh, fuck. And, you know, you're a good looking guy. You're a funny guy. You're a clean cut guy. You have, not that you're, you know, you say you've been rich and poor, but you're never really poor. You make more than the average asshole does.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So and it's like, I just don't get it. And you'd be with these girls, and then I'd be like, you know what? Fuck it. Okay, dude. Happy. Congratulations, dude. I'm behind you. That's the way, if you love her, then I fucking love her. Because you never know. Because my girl, I'm sure her girlfriends back in the day were like, why are you with this fucking piece of shit?
Yeah.
And she stuck with me, and I was able to evolve. And now we're happy, married, you know, blah, blah, blah. And all her friends, a lot of them are divorced. And, you know, the ones that were telling her not to be with me, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're like.
Yeah, of course. But you did a lot of work to become sane enough to.
Well, you did too. We both go to the same therapist.
Yeah.
We both go to Aaron.
The comedian's therapist.
Yeah, there's a. I don't even know if I've talked about this, but my therapist for the last, I don't know how many years. He does comics.
Yeah.
And mainly because he works on a scale, a sliding scale.
Yeah.
And he worked with one comic a long time ago, and they just kept passing it on.
Richard Lewis. We can say it because it's in Richard Lewis's book.
Richard Lewis. And then I got it from Dustin.
All right. I actually didn't get it from a comedian. I got it from a guy I've known. We've been friends, still friends since sixth grade, from JCC Basketball. That I don't want to say his name, but
I know who you're talking about because I used to come out of therapy, and he was always going in after me.
Yeah,
and I would tell Alan, look, if you're gonna make me cry or hit some real deep shit, hit it at the beginning.
Yeah,
because any given day you walk out and Lampanelli's there, or you're there, any comic in the world is there, and I'm not coming out fucking bawling.
Yeah.
And I would always talk my gossip about other comics at the beginning.
Yeah.
Because I knew I didn't want to, because he does play that radio out there, but I can still hear every once in a while name. And
yeah.
So I would always talk my shit about comics, my fucking resentments, right at the beginning.
Yeah.
Because I knew
it's a smart move. But the thing with that is that he totally gets it. And but my friend had gone to him. He had another avenue towards him because he doesn't only see comedians, take comedians in his office. But this guy, and then he told me his name, and I started to see him. He says he sees a lot of comedians there. He never mentioned your name or anything like that. But then I said, I'm seeing this guy, and I said, what's your guy's name? And you told me, and I was like, that's the same guy. That's scary. And then there was a time when we would be back to back for a while, and I remember you would come out. You would be coming in when I was coming out, and you would always say, did you leave some for me?
Yeah.
I remember. It was really great. He's been so helpful.
I would get mad when DeStefano was in before me. I'd be like, oh, fuck.
How do you follow that?
How do you follow DeStefano's therapy session?
Wow.
You know, he was just tired.
Yeah.
Exhausted.
Oh, my gosh.
But he's a fucking doll. He changed my life. He helped me change my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
He still is.
You did all the work, but he guided you, and that's what he does. But I just, you know, the thing with the relationships that I've had is that most people see a woman crying on the street, and they cross the street to avoid them, right. like they're a rabid dog. Yeah. And I generally buy them a house, and give them my PIN number for my ATM and a checkbook. And I think it's from coming from a divorced mother that I just see a woman in distress, and I need to try to make her happy at all expenses.
Yeah, dude, you. I mean, I would cut a.
And you're never gonna find more women in distress who are troubled than women comedians.
Yeah.
And I just there's always a point in every one of those relationships where I realize, oh, there's no helping this person. The first one was at Dane's Boston Garden taping. I was sitting with my girlfriend at the time, and she looked around. There were 18,000 rabid fans there, and she said to me with a glint in her eye that was frightening, she said, "I want this."
Ugh.
And I, instead of saying that's never going to happen, you're delusional, I said, you know, if you work hard enough, anything is possible. And that hurt her. You're undermining me.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
What, did she want it tomorrow?
Pretty much.
Oh, my God.
Pretty much. This was a woman who had been doing, like, comedy 2 years and couldn't understand why Sarah Silverman was one place and she was another. She was just as funny as Sarah Silverman.
Oh, God. Oh. And that ended.
Yeah. She moved in with another comedian.
Yeah. Friend.
Yeah.
Quote, unquote.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you hooked up with the other girl.
Yeah. Within 6 months of that, I met this other girl.
And you didn't heed my advice.
No.
In between.
You said she's crazy.
I said, don't date somebody with a headshot.
Yeah.
I told you that. Just don't date a regular human being.
Yep.
And you went out, you met another girl.
Yeah.
And then you were up country.
Yeah. And she talked me into buying a farmhouse and taking my money out of my IRA account and renovating and just.
You were up in fucking an hour away from New York.
If it was only an hour, I would have been there every night. I was driving back and forth 2 hours each way.
Is it 2 hours?
Yeah. 3 or 4 times a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
In the middle of nowhere. I remember
in the middle of nowhere.
You couldn't call me.
No, because I get no cell reception up there. Yeah.
And you're up in the, but in my brain, I went, you know what? He's my friend. I went, good for him. Maybe this is what he needs to do. Maybe he's going to come up with a couple novels.
Yeah, because of course I couldn't tell you, Bobby, I don't know what the hell I'm doing and I'm scared. I've been sucked into this and beaten down, and now I can tell you that. But the one thing is that I'm proud of is that as far away from New York as I was and how much time I had to spend on the road to make the payments on the house and taxes and everything like that, I kept my stand-up chops.
Yeah,
and I did a lot of shows. And I feel like I'm a better comedian now than I was last year and the year before and all that. And that's the only thing I can hold on to is that I abandoned my better senses and my defense of my self-esteem, but I never abandoned doing 300-400 shows a year.
Yeah. And now you're back in New York.
Yeah.
And you're doing spots every night. And it's fucking cool to have you back because, you know, people would always say, you know, where's Gary? What's Gary up to? Is Gary all right? Is he cool?
Yeah.
Because you were just gone.
Yeah.
Nobody knew where you were or what's Gary doing. And I would always say, he's doing good, man. He's doing shows. He's on the road. He's probably, you know, I would lie, but he's corporate, does a lot of corporate dates. I don't know if that's true or not.
It is true. I do a lot of corporate gigs, but I would, like, over the winter, I was on the road for 14 straight weekends.
But
Thursday to Sunday.
But now you're back in the city.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah.
Because, you know.
I love it. And this is where I'll be until.
You meet the next chick with a fucking headshot. The next hot broad comes
and
up.
We'll be right back.
And we'll be right back.
Oh, that was a good button.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm glad. I really am glad that you're back in the city because, you know, you're a fucking good friend of mine. You're back in the city. You're doing comedy. You're a great comic.
Thanks, man.
And, you know, it's kind of weird that now we're doing these shows together. We did that Atlanta gig together.
I was just going to bring that up, that going to Atlanta, it reminded me of how I always felt being around you. I always feel positive and creative and like a comedian, and to get those types of compliments from you, I can't look you in the eye when I say this. Alan always gives me a hard time. I can't really say anything.
Do it. Try it right now.
I'll try to look you in the eye and say this, but
look at me.
Right. Getting your approval or your, like, the respect of your peers, your respect as a comedian. When you told me when we were in Atlanta, you said, you know what, dude, you're a real fucking stand-up. You're not a famous guy or a guy who's getting by because he's on a TV show or something. You're a real fucking stand-up who talks about real shit, and you're honest, and you're just so precise with your words and everything, dude.
Yeah.
And I love this joke and that joke. And, man, I came back from Atlanta and I felt like $1 million. I was like, I felt good going in. I was doing good comedy and everything like that. But there's nothing like getting that pat on the back from one of your peers who you respect. Who I watched you that week and I was like, this fucking guy is taking it to a new level. And then you shared that with me. And it's hard for guys like us, New York guys, like getting a compliment from a New York comedian. I don't know the analogy for it, but they give out compliments only Colin Quinn is so positive. When you get a compliment from another New York comedian,
yeah,
whether it be good stuff or I like that joke or anything, it means something. Well, because they do not throw those out very lightly.
No, it's fucking real. And it comes out, and it has to be forced out of them.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, and it's like LA, you get them all the time. And it doesn't mean anything.
Doesn't mean anything. We love you.
Yeah,
that means nothing. That means nothing. But to hear, you know, Louis say, "I like that bit," or
I never heard that. Louis never said that.
or Gaffigan and his wife gave me a compliment one night. It's like, all right, now the entire audience could be standing, but it's that compliment from another comedian who you respect.
Right.
Not from some putz who's just trying to kiss your ass, but somebody you respect. And it's just like, that's success. I mean, it's
we had a good time too. I mean, that's why, you know, we did that Atlanta gig, and it was me and you on a show in these fucking weird little fucking venues.
Yeah.
And these basement fucking comedy clubs.
One of them was an old church.
One was an old church. And it was a fucking blast. And the fear of who goes up when or how or whatever, it's not there.
Right.
It's just...
Well, that's the thing with that the comedy seller really teaches you, is that, like, last night, right before me is Jim Norton, who couldn't be more opposite in styles.
Right.
And then you go up, and then somebody different goes on after me.
That's what New York does.
Yeah, that's what New York does. It makes you comfortable going on it. And Boston, back in the day.
Yeah, Boston.
We would have to go on after these guys who... People always say, why are Boston comedians so strong? Especially that, when you think about the group that we started with, Billy Burr, Dane Cook, Patrice O'Neill, Dwayne Perkins, and I'm sure we can... I don't know who we're leaving out.
Patrice
O'Neill... You and these guys, the hosts of those shows were always the best guys on the show.
Right.
And you had to go up in between, and the audience just fell in love with them, wanted them back, and you better grab their attention right away.
Yeah.
And it just...
Bob Marley,
the comedian Bob Marley.
You had 5 minutes to fucking kill.
Yeah.
But the thing is they wanted you to kill.
They did, but you didn't go... And you didn't go over, unless you were Patrice. You didn't go over, and you killed, and it was not mediocre killing. It was, you would have to destroy, or you weren't going to get back up on the stage. The hosts really were inspiring.
Well, it's cool too, to where we're at now, especially over the years. We've both had success. We've both been up and down. We've both had fucking these trials and tribulations, and now we're actually at a good place, you know, where it's kind of leveled out a little bit.
What was that thing I said today? I said that I had realized that we had everything we needed to be happy, except the realization that we did.
That wasn't it.
That wasn't it?
No. No. I really wanted it to be it because what you said was fucking great. I forget. Yeah. But it was basically what the point is like once you realize it's you know, if you don't have expectations in life, you have everything you need.
Right.
It's basically what you were saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the truth. It's like, look, we're both working. Yeah. You know, the next big thing is right around the fucking corner.
Yeah.
And we'll be up and we'll be down. It's a fucking roller coaster.
Yeah.
But we, you know, the one thing that anchors us to this fucking business is comedy. You can't take that away.
No.
You'll always be able to go to the Cellar and do a fucking 10-15 minute set.
Yeah.
You'll always be able to work the clubs.
Yeah.
You might, you know, there'll be guys bigger than you, younger than you, better looking than you, more money than you, and you'll be up there, you'll be down there. But
better looking?
Not better looking. Than you. Than you.
But Bob, the other thing that I always talk about comedians, talk to other comedians about is that, and this is true at every level, the millionaire comedians and the open micers, the thing that keeps us going, and I always say, if a guy loses this, just quit because it's not going to get any better than this. When a new joke works.
Yeah.
Oh, something you thought, you feel creative, you feel smart, you feel like you're productive and working, and
it puts 10 years on your career.
Yes, and at every level. And when, you know, I have these friends who are constantly, I'm not making a living, man. I want to quit. And it's like, you ever think of you still thinking new jokes? Yep. All right. You're not done yet. You're not done until something happens and you don't even want to write it down or go on stage that night and talk about it. Then you're done.
Yeah.
Anytime you, it's, I don't think it's a drug, but what do you think?
Oh, it's a drug.
Yeah.
Something gets released in our fucking brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely a drug because once you get that, it's from day one, the response of the crowd.
Yeah.
And when you think of something and say it on stage that night and it gets a laugh, you're like, fuck.
Yeah.
You know, you can't wait to the next night.
I remember seeing
the sickness of it is that, You got to move on at some point.
Yeah.
That's the hard part, is letting go of it and moving on to something new. Because, you know, you kind of get stuck in this, you know, this is the hour and you build this hour.
Right.
But everybody does it different, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody's different in how they do it. I mean, you know, guys are whipping out hours now every 6 months, which is kind of fucking...
Guys or Louis?
Okay. You're right, Louis.
Yeah.
It's like setting the curve.
Yeah.
And it's like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
Fucking stop. Stop making us look like shit. You know, really, six months? You motherfucker.
Yeah, it's still an aberration, and it shows you what kind of talent he is. But the other side of that, the feeling you get from the crowd, and I wanted to bring this up with you, just to, not here, but anywhere, is that I remember seeing that tribute to Greg Giraldo, and Jim Gaffigan, of all people, summed it up well, because I always think of him as just kind of a person who wouldn't bring up the emotional side of comedy because he's seems very private. But he said it's very difficult to go on stage in front of 1,000 people, whatever Greg was doing, and then go home to an empty hotel room at the end of the night, every night, and just shut it down. To turn off the adulation and the adrenaline and the feeling and either we want to eat or fuck or smoke or get high or cry or whatever. And it's just, it's a really hard thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, that happens a lot in New York City at that Comedy Cellar, because you're going on so late sometimes, 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, and it's such a rush, and then you have to go back. I walk my dogs, and I'm just this putz picking up shit on the streets in New York at 2 o'clock in the morning, and drunk 21-year-old girls are walking by petting the dogs and treating me like I'm a 90-year-old man.
Yeah,
but you know, what do you do to deal with that feeling when you get back to the hotel?
Netflix. Well, iPad.
Yeah.
Apparently what I do is eat.
Yeah.
Look at me. Yeah, dude, I have, you know, the addictions, and people are like, dude, just fucking, you know, just, you know, go to the gym or eat right.
Please.
It's like, look, man, it's not as easy as that. You do go back to that room and you went from being famous,
the highlight of these people's evening,
to taking pictures and talking to people, and
yeah,
to being by yourself in your underwear
with
24 channels at your fucking disposal.
Meanwhile, you can't wait to get away from all the adulation because you, we, at least me, it's just like I feel like a weirdo.
Yeah.
And have a hard time talking to strangers and everything like that. And then
I like talk. I can do it.
Yeah, you're really good at that, man. You're really good at it.
I feel so fucking mayor.
Yeah, I feel so self-conscious afterwards at those things, and I just want to get out of there. But then I don't want to be alone at the end of the night, and it's just
it's hard. It's hard. A fucking hard thing, but you know, it's, you know, it doesn't get easier, but you learn to deal with it differently. And you know, I'm learning to deal with it a little differently, you know, because it's like, you know, sex or banging broads or food or, you know, drugs in some people's cases or alcohol.
Yeah,
those aren't an option for me.
No.
And you know, it's easier to order, it's more acceptable to get a pizza.
Yeah.
You know, nobody gives a shit if you get a pizza and some chicken wings and become a fat fuck. So it's that's hard for me because that's one of my drugs.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I use to take the pain away, being on the road or being lonely and fucked up. That's what sucks. I wish it wasn't drugs. I don't want to say that. I'm glad I've been sober and clean for 25 years. But you know, it used to be sex. It used to be trying to get pussy. And you know, that kept me thin. I want to say to my wife, do you want me thin? Then let me bang bro. But listen, dude, we got to fucking wrap this up.
Yeah.
We got to get some food. And we got the show tonight.
Yes.
But I want you to come back on.
Oh, yeah.
I usually do it with Joe DeRosa.
Okay.
We'll come back on over to the house and just shoot the shit.
That'll be fun
one day, but I'm glad I got you on the podcast.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to doing this for a while.
You know, we'll fucking definitely love getting.
I made some eye contact.
You did. You made eye contact. Yeah. You had to do a character.
I did do a character.
You had to do me.
Oh yeah. That's right. Oh my god, I sidestepped it.
You sidestepped it, but you did good. You kept the eye contact as me. You weren't you.
But I did it as you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Wow, you're really.
But
sharp. Yeah. You're very perceptive, Dr. Lichter. The question is, can you turn that half-power perception against yourself?
Dude, Gary Gulman, what's your website, man?
GaryGulman.com.
GaryGulman.com. Make sure you go to his website. He's one of my favorite comics, one of my favorite people in the business. And he doesn't
look me in the eye and say that.
You're one of my favorite comics. You're one of my favorite people in the business. And I love you to death.
Oh, and he didn't do a character for that.
Not at all. Right in your face.
And I love you.
And
I love you, Robert Kelly.
Now it's getting gay.
You're a really good friend.
I'm uncomfortable.
Yeah, I know.
Stop.
Oh my god, put your shirt back on. Put your penis away. Your penis.
Your penis. Yeah, like you have to put it away.
That's how we talk.
you know, this has been great. This has been great, dude. Thanks for coming
it's
on.
It's a lot of fun.
And
thanks,
now we're gonna
man.
Do shows together.
Yes.
Yes. Gary Gulman, everybody. Thanks again for listening to another episode of You Know What Dude podcast on gloryholeradio.com. And make sure to check out all the other shows on the Glory Hole Network. If you're using the Stitcher app, type in the word fart when you register. iTunes users, don't forget to subscribe and leave a review. If you're a real fan of the show and you want to show your support, go to gloryholeradio.com/Robert Kelly and hit the donate button. $10 will get you a shout out on the air. $20 will get you my first CD, Robert Kelly Live, not available in stores. If you have any questions, email me at robertkelly@gloryholeradio.com.